The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for that continuous support. Last week, we were not able to finish a story about a Baltimore woman with terminal cancer. The article was Saving Miss Vanessa. While the article centered on her, the article also covered some of the advances in fighting cancer. Well, I don't want to leave you hanging, so I want to wrap that up a little bit, and I'll continue reading near the end. On a frigid Saturday morning in January, I met Miss Vanessa in her immaculate living room. It's been a journey, she told me, and with each step, I'm just so grateful that I'm still living. Today, after a year and a half of treatment with Keytruda, Miss Vanessa's tumors have shrunk by 66%. She still tires easily, and she has trouble walking due to the nerve damage caused by her earlier rounds of chemotherapy. She says her feet feel as if she's standing in sand, but she's deeply grateful to be alive. I'm on a 2-year clinical trial, and I asked Dr. Lee what's going to happen when the 2 years is up, Miss Vanessa told me. She said, I've got you. We're good. We're going to keep things going as is. According to Miss Vanessa, Lee told her to focus on spending time with the people she loves, doing things she loves to do. For Miss Vanessa, that means cooking. These days, Kira, her daughter, has to do a lot of the prep work, because the nerve damage also affected Miss Vanessa's hands, making it hard for her to wield a knife or vegetable peeler. She wears gloves to grab ingredients from the refrigerator. The nerve damage, again, which makes her extremities highly sensitive to cold. Sometimes, in the middle of making a meal, she needs to go lie down. Still, Miss Vanessa told me she thinks of every day as a blessing and listed the things she has been lucky enough to witness. Things she'd feared just a few years ago she would never live to see. I'm here to see Letty graduate from college, she said. I'm here to see Davion go into a new grade. I'm here to watch Zion start kindergarten. She trailed off, hardly daring to think about the milestones that await Zion's younger brother and sister, ages 1 and 2. When it's your time, it's your time. You can't change that. Everybody knows you live to die. But I don't think it's her time. And that was Saving Miss Vanessa by Robin Morantz Hennig. And a little bit about Robin Morantz Hennig. The science writer and former Guggenheim Fellow first reported on immunotherapy when it emerged 30 years ago, accompanied by a great deal of premature hoopla. When she returned to the subject to write about exciting new developments, Hennig was inspired to learn that scientists have been plugging away without a whole lot of support from the mainstream cancer community, and without a whole lot of funding. Hennig is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, an adjunct professor of journalism at New York University, and the author of 9 books. Her next is a science-based look at grandmotherhood. And now we read, The Future's So Bright, He's Gotta Wear Shades, by Dan Solomon. A high-wattage Texas Republican has become the unlikeliest hero of the Green Revolution. But can his electrifying example transform America's power structure? By Dan Solomon. The Future's So Bright, He's Got to Wear Shades. And he's a large man, kind of chubby in the face and hands. He's got shades on, and he fills the double-page picture of Smithsonian. Dale Ross, the mayor of Georgetown, Texas, has a big smile, a big handshake, and a big personality. In last year's election, he won big with 72% of the vote. The key to his success? Without being too self-reflective, he says, I just like people. He's a Republican, and his priorities are party staples. Go light on regulation, be tough on crime, keep taxes low. But the thing that is winning him international renown is straight out of the liberal playbook, green power. Thanks to his big advocacy, Georgetown, population 67,000, last year became the largest city in the United States to be powered entirely by renewable energy. Previously, the largest U.S. city fully powered by renewables was Burlington, Vermont, population 42,000. Home to Senator Bernie Sanders, the jam band Phish, and the original Ben and Jerry's. Georgetown's feat is all the more dramatic because it demolishes the notion that sustainability is synonymous with socialism and GMO-free ice cream. You think of climate change and renewable energy from a political standpoint. On the left-hand side of the spectrum, and what I've done, is toss all those partisan political thoughts aside, Ross says. We're doing this because it's good for our citizens. Cheaper electricity is better. Clean energy is better than fossil fuels. In a twist that has some Republicans in this oil and gas-rich state whistling Dixie, Ross is now friends with Al Gore, who featured Ross in An Inconvenient Sequel, the 2017 follow-up to An Inconvenient Truth, his Oscar-winning documentary about global warming. We bonded right away, Ross recalls. I said, Mr. Vice President, we've got a lot in common. You invented the Internet, I invented green energy. Trained as an accountant, Ross still works as one. Being mayor of Georgetown is a part-time job, and there's no mistaking his zeal for the other kind of green. When conservatives complain about his energy politics, he is quick to remind them that the city has the lowest effective tax rate in Central Texas. With Georgetown emerging as a brave new model for a renewable city, it makes sense to ask if others can achieve the same magical balance of more power, less pollution, and lower costs. In fact, cities ranging from Orlando to St. Louis to San Francisco to Portland, Oregon, have pledged to run entirely on renewable energy. Those places are much larger than Georgetown, of course, and no one would expect misty Portland to power a light bulb for long with solar energy, which is crucial to Georgetown's success. But beyond its modest size, abundant sunshine, and archetype-busting mayor, Georgetown has another edge, one that's connected to a cherished Lone Star ideal, freedom. America is embracing renewables slowly. In 2016, Massachusetts passed a law promoting a huge investment in wind and hydropower. The first megawatt is expected to hit the grid in 2020. Early this year, New York State announced plans to spend 12 years building the infrastructure for a $6 billion offshore wind power industry. Hawaii has pledged to be powered entirely by renewable energy in 2045. Atlanta's goal is 2035, and San Francisco's is 2030. Typically, plans to convert to sustainable energy stretch on for decades. Georgetown made the switch in less than 2 years. Ross, something of a libertarian at heart, entered politics because he was ticked off that the municipal code prohibited him from paving the driveway to his historic home entirely in period-appropriate brick. The code requires some concrete. He joined the city council in 2008 and was elected to his first term as mayor in 2014. He often likens the city to Mayberry RFD, and it does have a town square with a courthouse, a coffee shop, where you're bound to run into people you know, and a swimming hole. But it also has Southwestern University, and in 2010, university officials, following a student initiative, told the city council they wanted their electricity to come from renewable sources. The city had already set a goal of getting 30% of its power that way, but now Ross and his colleagues saw their opportunity. Taken together, the generation and distribution of electric power in the United States is an astonishingly complex undertaking. Utilities may generate their own power or buy it from other utilities. That power travels over a grid of transformers and high and low voltage lines to your house. Ownership of utilities varies from nonprofits to cooperatives to for-profits. Federal regulators ultimately oversee the grid. Amazingly, when you flip a switch, electricity is there. In Texas, the top energy sources had long been coal, natural gas, and nuclear. But perhaps surprisingly, the Lone Star State also leads the nation in wind power. Capacity doubled between 2010 and 2017, surpassing nuclear and coal, and now accounting for nearly a quarter of all the wind energy in the United States. Solar production has been increasing too. By the end of last year, Texas ranked 9th in the nation on that front. Which is to say that Ross and his co-workers had options, and the city was free to take advantage of them. Because of a rather unusual arrangement, Georgetown itself owns the utility company that serves the city. So officials there, unlike those in most cities, were free to negotiate with suppliers. When they learned that rates for wind power could be guaranteed for 20 years and solar for 25 years, but natural gas for only 7 years, the choices, Ross says, was a no-brainer. In 2016, the city bought its way out of a contract providing energy derived from fossil fuels and arranged to get its power from a 97-unit wind farm in Adrian, Texas, about 500 miles away in the Texas Panhandle. There is a simple map drawn on this page of where Georgetown is located. It looks like it's about 30 miles north-northeast of Austin. And the caption says, "Hotspot. Thanks to Texas' investment in transmission lines, Georgetown can get its power from points 500 miles to Adrian and 340 miles, Fort Stockton, away." Georgetown doesn't own the farm, but its agreement allowed the owners to get financing to build it. This spring, Georgetown is adding power from a 154-megawatt solar farm being built by NRG Energy in Fort Stockton, 340 miles to the west of the city. Even with plans to grow as much as 80% over the next 5 years, the city expects to have plenty of energy from these renewable sources. To be sure, about 2% of the time, the Georgetown utility draws electricity derived from fossil fuels. Ross says the city more than compensates at other times by selling excess renewable energy back to the grid at a profit. Other cities won't have it so easy. Take Atlanta. Residents buy energy from Georgia Power, which is owned by investors. As things stand, Atlantans have no control over how their power is generated, though that may change. In 2019, Georgia Power, by state law, has to update its energy plan. Ted Terry, director of the Georgia chapter of the Sierra Club, says the nonprofit is working with Atlanta officials to incorporate renewables, primarily solar, into the state's plan. Developing such energy sources on a scale that can power a metro area with 5.8 million people, as in Atlanta, or 7.68 million in the San Francisco Bay Area, or 3.3 million in San Diego, will prove challenging. But it doesn't seem impossible. In 2015, California set a goal of deriving 50% of its energy from renewable sources by 2030. Its three investor-owned utilities, Pacific Gas and Electric, Southern California Edison, and San Diego Gas and Electric, are poised to achieve that goal just 2 years from now, or 10 years early. Al Gore says the reason is innovation. The cost reduction curve that came to technologies like computers, smartphones, and flat-panel televisions has come to solar energy, wind energy, and battery storage, he says. I remember being startled decades ago when people first started to explain to me that the cost of computing was being cut in half every 18 to 24 months. And now this dramatic economic change has begun to utterly transform the electricity markets. Adam Schultz, a senior policy analyst for Oregon Department of Energy, says he's more encouraged than ever about the prospects for renewables. Because the Pacific Northwest features large-scale hydropower plants built as part of the New Deal, energy already tends to be less expensive there than the U.S. average. But solar and wind power have gotten cheaper over the last couple of years to the point that I can't even tell you what the costs are, because costs have been dropping so rapidly, Schultz says. We have enough sunshine, he says, presumably referring to the eastern part of the state, so it's just a matter of time. Because one obstacle to adopting wind and solar power is reliability, what happens on calm, cloudy days. Recent improvements in energy storage technology, aka batteries, are helping accelerate adoption of renewables. Last May, for example, Tucson Electric Power signed a deal for electric energy with storage, which can mitigate, if not entirely resolve, concerns about how to provide power on gray days. The storage upped the energy cost by $15 per megawatt hour. By the end of the year, the Public Service Company of Colorado had been quoted a storage fee that increased the cost of a megawatt hour by only $3 to $7, a drop of more than 50%. In a landmark achievement, Tesla installed the world's largest lithium-ion battery in South Australia last December to store wind-generated power. But by then, Hyundai Electric was at work in the South Korean metropolis of Ulsan on a battery that was 50% bigger. I asked Ross if he worries about what will happen to his city's power supply if it clouds up over Fort Stockton. He chuckles. In West Texas? Cloudy? He says. Really? In 2015, Ross wrote an op-ed for Time magazine about his city's planned transition to renewables. A town in the middle of a state that recently sported oil derricks on its license plates may not be where you'd expect to see leaders move to clean solar and wind generation, he wrote. Lest readers get the wrong idea, he felt compelled to explain. No, environmental zealots have not taken over city council. A little over a year later, Al Gore, one of the nation's prouder environmental zealots, showed up in Georgetown with a film crew to interview Ross for an Inconvenient sequel. In the film, when a reporter asked the former vice president whether Georgetown is a trailblazer for cities of similar size, he says, "Definitely." I asked Gore about the lessons he takes from Georgetown. I think it's important to pay attention to a CPA who becomes a mayor and takes an objective look at how he can save money for the citizens of his community, even if it means ignoring ideological presuppositions about fossil energy, especially when the mayor in question is in the heart of oil and gas country. Ross is now an energy celebrity, sitting on conference panels and lending Georgetown's cachet to environmental film screenings. And it isn't only conservatives who buttonhole him. As if to prove the adage that no good deed goes unpunished, he also hears from people who worry about the impact of renewables. They'll come up to me and say with a straight face, "You know what? Those windmills are killing birds," Ross says. "Oh, really? I didn't know that was a big interest of yours. But you know what the number one killer of birds is in this country? Domestic house cats. Kill about 4 billion birds a year. You know what the number two killer of birds is? Buildings they fly into." "So you're suggesting that we outlaw house cats in buildings?" They go, "That's not exactly what I meant." By Dan Solomon. There's a double-page graphic here titled "Capture the Sun, Harness the Wind." The outlook for renewable energy used to be dim. Now, thanks to better technologies, it's incandescent. The comparison to coal, and it shows a chart from 2016 to 2050, and renewables are going up at about a 45-degree level, and coal is going over fairly even, down just a little. The money flow, new investment in clean energy in the United States, in billions of dollars. Investment surged in 2011 because of spending under the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act and a push to build wind projects before the anticipated end of a production tax credit in 2012. That's a mouthful, I know. And it shows in 2009, it was $35 billion, 2010, $46 billion, 2011, $62 billion, that was the high mark, in 2012, $52 billion, 2013, $44 billion, 2014, $52 billion, 2015, $58 billion, 2016, $56 billion, and 2017, $57 billion. Big figure here, 800 energy storage in megawatts built in the United States in the last 5 years, and energy storage in megawatts expected to be added in a single year by 2020. 276, that's the weight in pounds of a Tesla Powerwall battery for residential use. 3,600 pounds, that's the weight in pounds a Tesla PowerPack 2 battery for commercial use. 12,000, the estimated equivalent in iPhone batteries to the weight of one PowerPack 2. 50,000, that's the number of coal industry employees in 2016. 102,500, that's the number of wind industry employees in 2016. It's almost more than double the coal industry. 260,000, that's the solar industry employees in 2016. The clean top 10, states marked by percentage of their electricity derived from renewable fuels. Solar includes only utility-scale solar. In 2009, Iowa, it's comparing 2009 and 2016 by these states. Iowa, 14% in 2009. In 2016, it was up to 35%. South Dakota, 5% up to 30%. Kansas, 5% up to 30%. Oklahoma, about 3.5% it looks like on the scale, to now 25%. California, 9% to now just under 25%. North Dakota, 8% to about 23%. I'm having to estimate on these lines because they're marked. Vermont, 0 to now nearly 20%. Colorado, about 7% to about 18%. Minnesota, just under 10% to just under 20%. And Nevada, under 5% to looks like about 17%. And Texas ranks 14th on the list, which it doesn't show past the top 10. And then it's got a graph here they call a duck curve, the typical graph of peak solar power available daytime and demand nighttime. Insolation, not insulation, but insolation, the fraction of the sun's radiant energy that reaches the earth. It's tiny, which is good, because the sun produces in 5 billionths of a second what earthlings produce in a year. Megafactory. The term was coined in 2014 for factories making batteries with a combined capacity of 1 gigawatt hour or more per year. And then there's an icon, the shape of Texas, with 6 over it. 6, where Texans would rank globally in installed wind capacity if it were a country. 6th. And another double page is a photograph taken, not sunset, but as the sun goes down, and very brown field in the foreground, and then on the horizon are just a numerous number of windmills. And then dark blue sky filling about two-thirds of the double-page photo. The caption, "Wind farms like the Spinning Spur 3, which powers Georgetown, have replaced prairie dog towns as the dominant feature of the Texas panhandle." There's another photograph of beer cans being filled, and the name of the beer is Wrench Brewery, R-E-N-T-S-C-H, and the caption says, "Brewed with Texas wind and Texas water by Texas people." It's one motto of the Wrench Brewery, a local supporter of the beer garden life. Another picture shows two young men making pizzas, and the caption says, "According to census figures, Georgetown is the nation's 5th fastest growing city with 50,000 residents or more. Its growth fueled in part by local businesses like the 600 Degrees Pizzeria and Draft House." presumably all users of renewable energy. We've got a few moments to read from Ask Smithsonian, and I always like to read as many of these as I can. How come I see fireflies in New York, Illinois, Iowa, and all through the South, but not in the West? From Todd Schmidt, Chico, California. Well, you can see fireflies in the West, but you have to look a lot harder, says Mark Branham, a research associate at the National Museum of Natural History and an associate professor of entomology at the University of Florida. There's kind of a firefly continental divide, and it has to do with flashing behavior among adults. Among eastern species, males flash while they're in flight to attract females. Those species don't live farther west than Kansas, except for a few isolated populations. Out west, it's the adult females that glow, but only while they're on the ground and very faintly. So faintly, their glow is hardly detectable, even to a human eye fully adapted to the dark. And few people venture out without a flashlight or other light on. Question: of the 120,000 Japanese Americans who were interned for security reasons during World War II, how many were convicted of spying against the United States? Asked Ted Ellswick of Fernley, Nevada. Answer: none, despite aggressive investigating. The U.S. government did convict 10 people of spying for Japan, and they were all Caucasian, says Adriel Lewis, curator at the Smithsonian Asian Pacific American Center. In 1988, President Ronald Reagan signed the Civil Liberties Act, which formally apologized for the internment and compensated each surviving internee with $20,000. Still, the Supreme Court has upheld the government's right to hold citizens without trial or hearings in wartime. Question: is the speed of light finite, or is it limited to 186,000 miles per second? Asks Chris Gibbons of Evergreen, Colorado. Yes, on both counts, says A.V. Loeb, a theorist at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. In 1905, Albert Einstein realized that the speed of light is a constant of nature. This serves as the basis for his special theory of relativity, which has been tested and confirmed by many scientists. It states that no material object can move faster than that speed, and that the speed doesn't change depending on the frame of your reference. If you're near the speed of light, time does slow down. So if you boarded a super-fast spacecraft, you would age more slowly than your relatives on Earth. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138.